This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Stark. I'm joined here with Shane Idy. He blogs at Emerging Hermit. Shane, it's great talking to you.
Great talking to you, Robert.
First of all, can you give us some background information about yourself?
Well, I'm a writer. I write fiction and essays. The essays are, I would call them kind of prose poems as well. I don't really know how to categorize them. I cover all kinds of different topics, and the fiction kind of tends to be all over the place too. I write under my name as well as the name Leroy Benes currently, and there might be some other names floating out there too, but the ones that come to mind. But I work on a lot of different fiction at once. I have a collection of short stories called Artists Go to Hell, and I also have a book under the name Leroy Benes called Cursed Rivalry, and then my nonfiction appears on emergenthermit.com and also in the Burning Block zine, which is currently digital. And a lot of that same material you're going to see on the website.
So, Artists Go to Hell, that's a fiction novel.
That is, yeah. And then I also have coming out at the end of the year, I have Contours of Nothing, which is kind of like a collection of aphorisms and little kind of short mini essays and just prose pieces.
What is Artists Go to Hell about?
It kind of deals with the theme of celebrity in general and just how people try to scapegoat and just crucify celebrities and kind of try to read all kinds of values into celebrities. Or even, not even just celebrities, but artists too. I mean, hence the title. But people will take artists and try to make them into a symbol for something they're not, or they'll identify with them, but there's also a lot of people that will try to punish them for something else that's not really related to them, whether it's something going on in culture or just something that they think the artist represents that they really don't. And so it kind of deals with that basic theme loosely in a lot of different ways. It kind of has that same theme expressed in lots of different ways throughout the course of the book. Some of the pieces are longer than others. Some are novellas. The title piece is called An Artist Goes to Hell, and it's about a kind of writer-poet, and he wakes up, and he's in this kind of prison, but it's also kind of an insane asylum, but it's not run very well. It's completely decentralized, and nobody really can give him a straight answer on why he's there. But he might be in hell, too, so it's kind of like, that's kind of the gist of it.
So it's very surreal.
Yeah, it's definitely surreal. It has a lot of surrealism in it.
Yeah, you do kind of see that theme in horror a lot. Like, someone wakes up somewhere, and they don't know where they are.
Yeah, I think a lot of that goes back to Kafka, that whole,
Yeah, for sure.
You wake up one day and you're something else and everybody's kind of trying to act like it's normal, but some people feel like it's off. I mean, that's a whole tradition that you see all throughout genre fiction of all types, whether it's just mainstream literature or sci-fi or horror, like I think you said.
Is there a particular genre or topic that you like to focus on?
I think that I'm somewhat of a phasist in that sense, so I will get really stuck on and obsessed with something for a while. And I will keep circling back to it. in the past, I've written a lot about politics. I'm not super interested in surface level politics as far as just events and things that go on, but I'm kind of interested in some of the kind of metaphysical ideas and psychological drives behind things that happen politically, and so I've kind of focused on a little bit of that stuff in the past. I'm tending to move a little bit away from that recently into other territory, but I was kind of, that was kind of an obsession for a while, as I think it was for a lot of people in the past couple of years, is not really surprising.
Yeah, but, political philosophy, yeah, or metapolitics as opposed to electoral politics and current events. So basically the how someone's psychological profile shapes their political outlook.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of things going on under the surface than just kind of what someone's opinions are. There's a lot of incentives and desire mechanisms that are going on there that will shape how someone feels about all that stuff. And that was always kind of something of a focus for me rather than just who is running or who's in office, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely a theme in your article on the Starkian Alt Center. What are some specific examples that you've came across of how someone's psychological profile impacts their political outlook?
Well, it's kind of an interesting question because you could take that all kind of different ways. I mean, my hope is usually when I'm looking at that stuff that I'm not, I mean, I've probably not been very good at it in the past. I always try to get better at it, but I try not to assume too much about people. I mean, I think the best place is to maybe start with myself and kind of see what my own motivations are, where that stuff goes. And I ask myself, why do I have this opinion, or why does this certain political preoccupation seem so important to me? And then if I examine myself, I can maybe get something of an answer. And as a writer, sometimes you miss it, and sometimes you hit it on the mark. It's hard to say. I mean, I try to, it really is kind of a difficult question, I would say. I think that lately, what you see happening, especially with internet culture, is you see a lot of terms being thrown around, and they have a common usage which we are all supposed to understand and use a certain way. If you call somebody a socialist and you're a libertarian, or you call somebody a right-winger and you're a socialist, I mean, those have very specific meanings, even if they don't have much to do with the original meaning behind the words or how those movements started. It's as much about who is saying them as it is about what's intended behind them saying it and calling something that.
Sort of that concept that Giovanni Donato wrote about of the neurotribe, how people are forming groups based on, unintentionally, based on their personality type, and then that transcends into politics.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept, the neurotribe that he wrote about, and that also ties into the, I believe he called it, he said something similar about a neotribe earlier on in his writings too, but yeah, he tapped into something there and gave a name to something that I think that a lot of people are actually kind of feeling, even if they're not privy to his writings, and even if they don't have much to do with what he or what you or what a lot of the people that you have on your podcast think. I think that it's sort of just an intuitive feeling that's in the air. That's kind of the direction we're headed, is a lot of people are more interested in how you can form communities that are based on sort of affinity and also desire, which is it's fascinating. I mean, you're seeing a lot of different expressions of that, and I feel like every little ideological group almost has their own version of that. They just call it something different.
So your book, Contour of Nothing, a nonfiction collection of aphorisms. So each chapter loosely follows a theme. You have politics, relationships, art and artist, and religion and spirituality. Do you touch upon that theme in particular of how the psychology motivates politics?
I don't know that I address it explicitly as in the way that we're talking about it now, but it is just sort of always there on the periphery. I mean, something like that is written sort of as a mosaic. You can take each little aphorism in isolation, but if you read an entire chapter, you're going to get maybe kind of a, I don't know, maybe an idea of, I mean, you're definitely going to get something of an idea of maybe what my worldview is, or at least you get some trajectory of it. But more than that, I would hope that people would ask themselves interesting questions afterward. And I think that what I tried to do in those writings was explore a lot of different subjects. And so if that relates at all to this topic, it would relate in the sense that there's just a lot of variety there, and that there's a lot of different ways of thinking about things. And so if you have a lot of different groups that all have a very different idea about how to live, that's going to lead to a world of variety. And I think that that's welcome. I think it's great to have a lot of different expressions of how things should be, you know?
Yeah, that was my impression of reading it. Each of the aphorisms themselves cause one to ask interesting questions, but I didn't really get like an overall theme. Like, it's hard to read it and get like a clear idea of the point of view of the author.
Yeah, and I think that was somewhat intentional. I really didn't want it to be a super polemical piece of writing. I didn't want somebody to read it, say, the way they would read, I don't know, like some kind of self-help book or some kind of, it's definitely not going to read like your standard kind of like Barnes & Noble political section, like this is why liberals are ruining America kind of book. It's not that kind of book at all. It's very much trying to explore different possibilities. And I mean, and a lot of those things that I'm discussing anyways, whether it be in that book, whether it be politics or philosophy or just interpersonal relationships, a lot of that stuff is explored more kind of like in its essential nature. I was trying to stay away from current events or trying to comment upon any specific thing that would be happening today. It was more just kind of like trying to, even when I reference things that are happening today, like the internet and things like that, I was trying to get more to something essential that's going on underneath. I don't know how well it comes off, but that was my intention.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, because with a lot of bloggers, you go on your blog and you immediately put that blogger into a political or cultural box that you can check. But if you go into your blog, unless you read all the articles pretty extensively, it's not super easy to figure out what your outlook is. Is that
intentional? Yeah, that might not be the best for marketing, certainly. It might be easier to be like in a slot, but I think I'm okay with it for right now. I mean, sometimes that worries me a little bit. I'm like, I worry that somebody would take one piece and base everything else off of that and be like, oh, this guy's like some kind of, I mean, I might write something that to me seems iconoclastic just because it goes against, I don't know, what the current dissident sphere thinks or something at the moment. But then I'm like, well, people are just going to think I'm an SJW for writing this, you know what I mean, or something like that.
You're not connected to any kind of political group, whether it's the left, libertarians, or the alt-right. You're pretty independent, or you could say politically homeless.
Yeah, very much so. It's I'm really an apolitical person at the end of the day. I don't, I'm not an anarchist or anything like that. I kind of just am of the opinion that there's no ideology that has a good final absolute interpretation on how best to do things. And I think that you have to deal with reality as it's in front of you. You can't hope for some kind of political fantasy world or any other kind of fantasy world that may come later on if you keep, you know, going the direction you want things.
Because I noticed that you do have a post and attempt at self-description, but it's still like you basically write some of your critiques of political ideology, but it's still not super direct or clear what your political ideology is.
Yeah, and I think that's because it's not really that clear to me either. And I think that even since I wrote that, I kind of like look back at that and go, is this a very good description? I don't even know if it is, but nevertheless, I just put it down on paper because I thought that, or, you know, on screen anyway, because I thought that it would be a interesting thing to do, because I felt like up until then I hadn't really done that before. I hadn't really tried to kind of nail down any kind of description of what I think. I guess it would be more an approach than an ideology. It would be more of a style as to how I approach things.
And, yeah, I mean, it's terrible for marketing, but I think overall people would be better off, in a sense, analyzing each issue by issue. I mean, the problem is, I guess, well, it can be good. It's a good thing and a bad thing in a different sense. It's a bad thing when people have to check, like, one box, like you're a liberal, conservative, or maybe a libertarian. But it's a good, I mean, that's a bad thing because people treat politics like a religion. But I guess with the whole issue of creating a neo-tribe, if everyone can find a particular niche for their own unique ideology, that would be more of a positive thing. But the whole idea of a lot of people, because they don't really want to have to think everything through, I guess it's easier that way to just say, I'm going to be a liberal or I'm going to be a conservative.
Yeah, definitely. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being any of those things, and I don't take any issue with people having a political identity or subscribing to those. I mean, it's...
Did you subscribe to an ideology at one point?
Yeah, definitely. I've run through many. I mean, when I was growing up, I was in a very conservative home, and so that was just kind of the default position that I was in for years. And then when I was in high school, that was when the war in Iraq had started, and I was against the war. So for like 2 weeks, I thought I was a liberal, and then I spent years thinking of myself as an anarchist before I kind of checked that too, and realized I didn't subscribe to that because I didn't agree with their view of what power is on a fundamental level. I thought it was flawed, and so I kind of just moved on from there into being just independent, and I don't. And I don't engage in any political activity on principle. I would hope to engage in any political activity for pragmatic reasons, even if it's just in writing. I mean, I try to approach things just as I see them. And I know that can be a problem because you can't really just take every situation in isolation. It always has a bigger context. It always has a historical context and a socio-political context and all kinds of other contexts that are crossing over. But to me, that's what keeps it interesting, is that I can try to take the wide view and look at it from those different angles.
There's this concept of a radical center. Basically, you've written about this. It means that your views overlap the left and the right, but you're anti-establishment, and you're opposed to the direction that we're heading in now. That's what the radical center is. But the problem is that term's been co-opted by a lot of establishment hacks.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Didn't Hillary Clinton at one time call herself a radical centrist or something?
I'm not sure I don't remember Hillary Clinton, but a lot of the types of people that would support her. Like, it's gotten to the point where I, just out of curiosity, I typed in radical center or alt center on Twitter, and they said an alt centrist is someone who equally dislikes both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. But yeah, it's basically the establishment crowd, the people. I mean, I'm not necessarily a big fan of the way things are going with Trump, but back in the 2016, like, you had these establishment types who strongly disliked both Trump and Bernie, and they were more for Hillary, and basically using, like, describing that crowd as radical centrist.
Yeah. I think that it's been used so many different ways that, I mean, I don't regret using it, but I do understand that it's probably not the best term, because it might instill all kinds of ideas into people's minds. It's kind of unpredictable. I guess the way that I was using it was, I was kind of just using it in this very free kind of speculative sense, because I was trying to understand a theory of sovereignty that didn't belong strictly to the right or the left. It might have elements of it. It's not a mix necessarily of both, but it definitely overlaps in places with both, just because when you're trying to approach sovereignty in a new way and you don't feel like either the right or the left have a monopoly on what sovereignty means, you're going to go into some new territory and also cover some that's been done before. But yeah, you're definitely right. I've seen some of the strangest people use that term, or not strange people, but I mean, like, use it in really strange ways or in ways that just don't really seem much different from just like vanilla flavored, like establishment centrism, you know?
And yeah, that's kind of what happened with the alt center. So initially I was just saying that the alt center is kind of a hybrid of the dissident left and dissident right. And that's a very kind of simplistic definition. But then as it evolved, these sort of unique ideas started emerging out of it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that's one of the things that's so interesting about the movement is that as somebody who is an observer, just as an observer of that movement, and having read your writings, you know, and Giovanni Donato and some of the others, what I find interesting about it is that there's this sense in which it's organic on the one hand, but on the other hand, you guys were definitely trying to kind of, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you guys seem like you're trying to create a movement, and it was very conscious. It doesn't seem like it was quite like some of the other parts of the dissident sphere, like the dissident right and the dissident left. It was very much like, okay, these guys have done this. This is kind of our turn. Like, why don't we try to actually do something very conscious with it?
Yeah, originally I put out that idea as just kind of a hybrid where the dissident right and dissident left overlap, and that seemed a little bit contrived. But then as people started exchanging ideas, like unique ideas emerged from there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, it's going to kind of furrow some brows when you talk about something like aristocratic socialism. That's immediately on both, I think, on both sides of the political spectrum. People are going to distrust that a little bit, but they're also going to be a little bit interested. It sounds very provocative.
Well, yeah, like with smart socialism, a conservative will have a knee-jerk reaction because of the word socialism. But then a liberal, they might be intrigued at first, but then they might say, oh, that's my they might say it's like quasi-fascist.
Yeah, definitely. But if they were to actually look at kind of the nuance of what you and some of the others were saying in those respects, I think they would find that there's a lot of interesting things going on there. I mean, you're not talking about necessarily, at least, I mean, I could be wrong here, but it doesn't seem like you're talking about, like, wanting to return to a super literal, like, aristocracy in the sense that some of, like, the trad and, like, neo-reaction
right.
folks do. But you're talking more about a value system and kind of, like, a whole, an approach to, it's kind of an approach to life. It's not really, like, a political system so much. But, I mean, it could express itself probably in many different ways, I imagine.
Yeah, it's not aristocracy in a literal sense, but aristocratic radicalism is about this, it's about getting sort of like the best ideas and the most creative potential out there, and the kind of people who can't, like, it's not left-wing egalitarianism, but it's basically stating that free markets aren't sufficient and helping those people rise up.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, and unfortunately, I don't have the notes in front of me. I wish I did, but, or at least I don't have names or anything. But one thing I find that's interesting about a lot of really early socialists is that they were also nobles and came from kind of aristocratic stock. So, I mean, there was a lot of socialist feeling amongst aristocrats, like after kind of the age of the Enlightenment and kind of after the French Revolution.
Oh, yeah, because they were being kind of pushed inside in favor of the mercantile class. So basically, I mean, the issue with capitalism and mass consumerism is the person who becomes wealthy is the person who markets their product to the largest numbers of people, and that sort of pushes aside sometimes like the best, or I don't even have to say the best. You can say the best, or you can just say something that's like a unique niche that, as far, it could be political ideals, it could be It could be art, or it could just be a product. If they're not able to tap into that large market that you do under capitalism, they're not able to succeed.
Yeah, so in that sense, capitalism is anti-aristocratic in a way, at least as we experience it today.
Yeah, I mean, people, because look, a lot of wealth is generated from things like Walmart or fast food, and you have a lot of great intellectuals and artists are impoverished.
Yeah, the starving artist kind of thing. It's at this point, it's so ingrained in our intellectual consciousness. It's like we don't even think twice about it. Yeah.
Yeah, and then from there, I guess different policies would emerge to how to address that. But a lot of that concept, I don't know if I'd say it's Nietzschean, it's definitely influenced by Nietzsche, but Aleister Crowley was the one who primarily expressed those views.
Yeah, I remember reading a little bit about some of his political views, and I thought it was interesting. He was kind of a complicated person politically. He was kind of all over the place. But yeah, I remember him using the phrase aristocratic communism at one point, and thinking that that sounded kind of hilarious, but also kind of interesting. And it seemed like, there's that sense in which you could think some of these issues through as far as capitalism. You can definitely have certain sentiments that would seem very right-wing, but for left-wing reasons. And you can have these sentiments that seem very left-wing, but like for right-wing reasons. It's not always, some of these issues don't really necessarily belong to one or the other. Sometimes it seems like one or the other side actually has the answer to the other's problem.
Well, yeah, I guess smart socialism would be the kind of economic system that would best benefit you. I guess I'm looking up where how you describe smart socialism. A healthy degree of competition without social Darwinism, or basically a third way between egalitarianism and the winner takes all.
Oh yeah, it's like a good way for people of talent to have some place in society without having to compete with people that are just more vicious at the end of the day. That's really all the talent they have. There's a place for those people, right? I mean, but I think that they shouldn't control what the arts do or what aesthetics are available, you know?
Yeah, so smart socialism would be geared to helping those people rise up. The thing is, like, a lot of these issues that Giovanni Donato was discussing about in terms of smart socialism, because it has, like, the element of eugenics, that's probably why it would almost practically be toxic to the left.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I think he said, like, supporting smart socialism would be supporting, like instead of, like, your typical single mom who's on welfare, like, subsidizing, like, high-IQ women to have lots of kids. So, yeah, that they would basically consider that eugenics.
Yeah, people are going to have... That's definitely going to cause some people's hair to stand on end. I mean, it's totally taboo in our society, but I mean, if you think about it, I mean, it's hard not to see some kind of eugenic program in all kinds of stuff that's going on. I don't think it's intentional, but I mean, in a world like ours where you kind of have these big political and corporate entities that are trying to get their own ends and goals across, I mean, they have to take certain measures, whether that's war or filtering lots of money into certain areas to help out things like this. I mean, those all kind of have like a eugenic kind of context to them, even if it's not totally intentional. I mean, anytime you're allowing certain groups of people to thrive, that is going to have a kind of eugenic effect, and it's going to have genetic consequences that people may not take into consideration.
Yeah, I guess all systems are like that, so any kind of political or economic system is going to favor a particular demographic group, and that particular group is going to thrive or decline under a particular system. So for the people who would put out that argument about smart socialism, I mean, if they're going to make a moralistic argument, it's no more, it's really no more so than existing systems that we have now.
Yeah, I guess one of the questions that I would have about smart socialism, and maybe you could answer this better than I could, just because something I've wondered, but I've not spent a great deal of time on it. It's an interesting idea, but I would then wonder kind of what the metric is. Like, what are you trying to select for? What do you consider best? You know, and I guess that could just come into the whole neurotribe thing, and maybe every tribe has its own standard or idea of what is the best and what it's trying to select for. But yeah, I don't know. I found that interesting concept. I just don't know how that plays out.
Yeah, because, yeah, coming up with the kind of the metric of what is the best, because you have all these different tribes with their own value. So I don't think if smart socialism were to be implemented on a strong centralized basis, then yeah, it would have to come up with some metric of what is the best. Some people might just say it's IQ. We should give like a higher basic income to people with higher IQs, or subsidize higher IQ people to have more kids. But then I guess there's another basis for smart socialism where you have all these different neo-tribes and their own interest, just giving like those kinds of people like the more opportunities. And you could even say, I mean, look, Andrew Yang's basic income is not exactly smart socialism that Giovanni Donato advocates. But one of this blogger line of the blogosphere, he actually said he used that term to describe Andrew Yang's platform, because basically, like, it's scrapping the current, well, he's not going as far as to scrap the current welfare state, but a UBI rather than the welfare state in its current form, you could make the case, is maybe not full-on smart socialism, but a step in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, like, UBI kind of, it's that weird, I mean, it would almost be like the opposite, I would think, just because like if everybody's getting the exact same thing, it would kind of...
Yeah, it's not smart socialism, but it's, I guess, a step in that direction if you take into account the system we have now. I know the line of blogosphere, he had a blog post where he talked about like public housing for the intelligent yet poor. So that's like a specific policy that fits into smart socialism.
Oh yeah, I haven't read that particular piece. That's interesting.
I know with the whole alt center, Rational Wiki said that the alt center is really just a rebranded alt right. I guess there's going to be, of course, there's going to be some degree of overlap, but you would not say that's necessarily accurate. What would you say is a significant contrast between the alt-center and alt-right?
That's an interesting question. That's a loaded one. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that the whole alt sphere is a very complicated thing. It's complicated because people use these terms to describe themselves, and then they also use it pejoratively. And sometimes it seems like the people that use the term to describe themselves, well, take the alt-right for instance. Didn't it kind of seem like the alt-right was thousands of people bigger once Hillary Clinton mentioned them?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So I mean, a lot of people self-identified with that, even if they weren't totally sure what that meant. They just knew that they were all in the same boat together. But they might not have actually known very much about who Richard Spencer was or kind of what some of the nuances were and some of the little weird movements that came before it were. And, you know, and so it kind of grew into this weird thing. You kind of have like the pre-Hillary Clinton TV mention of it, alt-right, but then you also have the post one, and then you also kind of have what it turned into after Charlottesville when it was super demonized, and suddenly people that had once identified with it were saying they were never identified with it and all of this kind of stuff. So it's kind of like this weird amorphous thing. I think there's a lot of different things you could say to contrast between the alt-right and the alt-center, but I would say probably the main one is a big, huge structural one, and that's this. It does seem like the Alt Center, to me, is much more of a movement that it's kind of, it's probably isn't the best description, but it seems kind of self-aware. It seems like a thing that wants to be expressed, not necessarily in favor.
Oh, I think you said that the Alt Center is unintentionally ironic.
Well, I don't know if I would say unintentional. I think it does seem like it's intentional. It seems like, I think I was talking more about the Starkian brand in particular, though, when I was talking about that. Because, I mean, the Starkian brand, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, it does exist within the greater umbrella of the Alt Center.
So if you had to list figures in the Alt Center, like five people, it would be me, let's see, Giovanni Donato, the Matthew P. Pegasus Alt of Cinderblog, I guess Francis Nally.
And then Brandon Adamson.
Yeah, Brandon Adamson. Well, he called it, his site was initially called Alt-Left, Left of the Alt-Right, or Left Wing of the Alt-Right.
Right, yeah.
And he definitely, he had the manifesto, but yeah, he's basically Alt-Center.
Yeah, he definitely informed ideas in the movement, even if he doesn't self-describe that way. But I mean, yeah, definitely you guys, I would say, are the ones who are basically the center of the movement, and let me think that that's pretty clear. But I think that what's interesting to me is that all of you don't really seem to have an ideology together. You don't have, like, a creed or anything. There are specific returning interests that are very important, like aesthetics and functionality. But beyond that, it almost seems like it's more, the commonality is more structural rather than ideological.
Yeah, I guess a way to look at it, like, there's not like a specific political ideology, but you have a group of people on the political compass who are politically homeless, and then you take those people who are closest to each other ideology, and they kind of form a group, and then from there it evolves from there. Because I guess that's probably the origins of the Alt Center, was there was this group that was politically homeless, and they kind of existed on the periphery of the alt-right. And then eventually it kind of evolved into that. So it starts off very loose, but then all these different ideas, these unique political ideas kind of come together from there.
Yeah, and I guess maybe another way I could get my point across better is by bringing your book into it. So in Journey to Vapor Island, you can tell me if I'm totally off here, but when I read that book, I get the sense that you're reading something that is definitely expressed. I mean, if anybody's familiar with your ideas or with Giovanni Donato's ideas and, you know, Brandon Adamson and Francis Nally, and you, or even just like the entire dissident sphere, there's a lot of parody of that stuff going on in there. There's kind of this whole critique of that whole dissident culture, but at the very same time, there's also ideas being expressed that are not necessarily parody. At times, it almost seems like it's parodying its own ideas. And so there's this sense in which the greater umbrella of the Alt Center, if it has anything in common with that, it's that it's aware of its own limitations. It doesn't try to put forth some kind of ideological dogma, but it is definitely taking these things that might or might not work. And I just felt like in the Starkian brand in particular, it seemed like there was this tendency towards irony. Like, it was almost like you were having a lot of fun with these ideas. It wasn't just like, hey, these are my ideas and I think they're better than other people's. It was like, these are some ideas and they're also really fun too.
Yeah, I'd say that was true with the book. So there's one angle of the book where it's sort of it's a parody of memes and a parody of a lot of these dissident right themes. But on the other hand, it's also looking at these issues in a serious manner and to the degree that you're actually, the audience should be sympathetic to these ideas. Like, sometimes, like, whether it's a joke, whether you're making fun of something, and I would say, yeah, I would say it's simultaneously both.
Yeah, and it's that's what makes it also interesting, and I guess to go back to your earlier question as far as distinction you can make between, or the biggest distinction you can make between the alt-right and the alt-center is I feel kind of like the alt-center is more lighthearted. I feel like the alt-right is really stringent and suffocating and honestly not that interesting.
I recently interviewed Rachel Haywire about her campaign for president. I don't know if you know who she is. And she used the word beyond the center. So she made the comparison that you have a horseshoe and then the establishment centers at the bottom and you have the left and the right. And beyond the center is the space in between further out. And she said people who get called degenerate by the right or get pushed out by the politically correct police on the left.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not, I've heard her name. I'm not totally familiar with her work, but that those comments are interesting and I think definitely representative of a certain corner of culture, like you've said.
Because, yeah, originally that article was saying it was rebranded alt-right. But I wouldn't say, the thing is, the alt-center was openly honest that it overlaps both the dissident right and dissident left. But I guess what it says, Giovanni Donato had this concept. They said his concept of neo-tribalism, they just called it rebranded white nationalism.
Well, that's... you said that? Was that Rational Wiki?
Rational Wiki.
Well, that's kind of silly, because I feel like if you actually read his writings on it, it's pretty evident that he's talking about... he's talking about a pretty versatile phenomenon. He's talking about something that you could almost even equate it to, like, Max Stirner's Union of Egoists or something. Like, you could just as soon say that it's a bunch of Star Trek fans that want to start their own nation or something. I think that Keith Preston, I feel like he even described, like,
His own...
Yeah. I mean, his idea is a little bit different than that, but I mean, I feel like he even used similar language to talk about that kind of thing. I didn't get the impression that it was explicitly ethnic that he was talking about. It could be any number of affinities that you're tracing this kind of tribe along, I would think.
And yeah, if someone was calling themselves a neo-tribalist in the 60s, they probably would have been dismissed as like a crazy leftist.
The neo-tribalist, what have you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible. It's interesting how some of these things leap between left and right, depending on, I mean, the right and the left have changed many times. It's really interesting how certain issues can jump from one side to the other, just kind of depending on what the cultural climate is. That's one thing that I think people should remember, and it's okay that they do. I wouldn't dismiss any of the issues on those grounds, but I think it's very interesting to pay attention to.
You had another article that you wrote earlier about the alt center. Did your views change on the second article as opposed to the initial response?
Yeah, definitely. The first article was kind of like me blogging in a bloggery kind of way about a bloggy thing. It was kind of like sometimes write like they're doing a drive-by shooting. They're not really hitting a target. They're just kind of like shooting at a building, you know? And so it wasn't very efficient, and I felt like it deserved a second look, especially with... I think that my opinion at the time was that it was just this sort of weird internet phenomenon that was kind of interesting but kind of kooky. But then as time went on, I was kind of like, oh, well, it kind of seems like the world itself, or at least, you know, the world over here in America. In America. Or in the West, maybe. I don't know. I hate using that phrase, but I'll use it anyway. It seemed like the West was going kind of like an alt-center direction anyway, so it kind of caused me to rethink some things, and I felt like it was a subject that deserves a lot more scrutiny than I'd initially given it.
You had an article about some of the thinkers who have influenced the concept of a radical center and your own views, so you list Gore Vidal, Nietzsche, Max Stirner.
Yeah, there's a lot of different people in there. There was also like Bataille and Klosowski and I was trying to list people, not people who had self-identified that way, but people who I felt had some spirit of a alternative, a radical version of centrism, that, or if there was anything political to be gleaned from their writings, it wasn't cut and dry, right or left, even if they self-described themselves as one or the other.
Well, yeah, Gore Vidal had interesting views, because in the past he was described as of the left, but he was basically, he was an isolationist. He one time critiqued mass immigration, so he's someone who doesn't fit neatly. He didn't fit neatly on the left or the right. He had kind of like, kind of third position.
Yeah, definitely. Gore Vidal is a very interesting one, because he's often seen as kind of like this, kind of like a radical golden boy of the left. But I mean, if you look at some of his earlier writings, I mean, he was criticizing feminism. He described himself as a populist when he was more involved in politics. He even kind of poked fun at some Jewish journalists and kind of made fun of their almost, which like today that would be outrageous, but you had this very leftist person doing it back then. It would seem crazy by today's standards, but I mean, like, if you go back and look at it, I mean, he was very taboo, I would think, or at least today, I would think that he'd be taboo to both the left and the right, but I mean, people remember him a certain way, you know? Oh, and he was also in favor of eugenics.
Oh, right, yeah. So yeah, there are all these people, prominent figures, so who don't neatly fit into the left or the right. So that article you said, it's not just about people who are politically homeless, but there are some core principles. Did you say the main one was the concept of sovereignty?
Yeah, it's, well, to me, it's, both the right and the left have a very different idea of what sovereignty means, I think. I think that on the left, it tends to be that sovereignty is kind of like this ubiquitous phenomenon that belongs to everybody. And then on the right, there's this idea that, I don't know if it's super cut and dry, if I can nail it down, but on the right, it does seem kind of like it's more central to a specific metaphysics, whether that be in the past, I mean, it was definitely the church, and then moving on up to today, you kind of get a sovereignty of the individual. And I mean, these are not perfect definitions by any means. I mean, these all keep changing, but I mean, that's the nature of sovereignty, though, is that, and I think that's what I was trying to explore initially when I spoke of a radical center, for whatever I intended it to mean or whatever it means now. I was trying to explore a different way of thinking about sovereignty, because that might be at the heart of some of the issues that are going on today. I'm not positive, but I think there's space for kind of like a reconfiguration or maybe a redefining of what sovereignty even is.
On your site, you write parody of book reviews. Can you give some examples of when you wrote?
Oh, yeah. The only one, the most obvious one that comes to mind is I wrote a fake book review for a book called Incel. It's one I totally made up. It's just about a kid who, his name is Pat, and he gets seduced by this femme fatale named Nadia, and she convinces him to cause his mother to overdose on oxycodone, and then they go on this kind of like crazy road trip together, like natural born killers, and they go to kill all the women that have rejected him together, and then it turns out she might be like a Russian robot and all this stuff.
Was that initially an idea you had for your own novel?
I think that's one of those ideas that I sat down for a minute and I thought, this would be so hilarious and disgusting and funny if I could actually have time to write this, but I don't, and I don't know that I would want to. It's more just like a funny premise that I would tell people about, and I'm like, well, why don't I just write a fake book review, and then it'll be funny that way. Maybe somebody will be inspired by the book review to actually write the book. If they want to, go ahead.
We're at the end of the show. Shane, do you want to plug your upcoming book release?
Yeah, definitely. It is called Contours of Nothing. You can pre-order it now on Smashwords, Barnes & Noble. It'll be available for Kindle in a few months here as well. But yeah, and you can find information about it on my website, emergenthermit.com. And that's that.
Shane, Idy, it's been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks for having me, Robert.